Okay, hi everyone. I know we're still waiting on some folks to join, but a couple of reminders before we get started today. My name is Molly Marin. I am the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. A copy of today's PowerPoint is available on our webpage if you wanted to grab that and follow along. Oh, actually, I don't think it's on there. I will do that in the next 2 minutes, okay? too many webinars this week, but I will do that. I apologize for the delay. It got half loaded. At the end of today's presentation, I will post a very brief evaluation, a link to an evaluation. You'll also get that via email. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we very much appreciate the feedback. Also, during today's presentation, if you could please use the chat box for any questions or comments you may have, you can type in it throughout. They'll probably break midpoint, and of course, there'll be time at the end for questions. Today is the last webinar in our Understanding RTI in Mathematics series. All information about upcoming webinars, including our database decision-making and an RTI process, which is currently on the schedule, can be found on our webpage at nysrti.org. We are very pleased to have back with us again today Dr. Russell Gersten, and along with him we'll have Dr. Sarah Powell today. Dr. Gersten is a professor with the College of Education at the University of Oregon and director of Instructional Research Group in Southern California. He served on the National Math Panel, co-chairing the Committee on Instructional Practice. He also chaired the panel that created a practice guide for RTI Mathematics for the U.S. Department of Education. In his 20s, he reviewed R&B for Rolling Stone and the Boston Phoenix and interviewed many of the stars of that era, such as Al Green and Gladys Knight. At this point, I would like to welcome Dr. Gersten back, and he will introduce Dr. Powell.
Hi. This is the last webinar, and the title is intentionally, as I've mentioned before for those of you on earlier ones, Understanding RTI, because the goal here isn't necessarily to tell you what to do, but to give you some guidance and wherever possible evidence to help you guide making decisions, including using resources intelligently and collecting data that will be used. And that's one of the themes we stressed in screening, and we're going to come back to it today. There's a little switch. Originally, the state had asked that this be on progress monitoring. And I thought, for a couple of reasons, and I'll turn to that slide, that it would be good to shift this to focus very heavily on what's often called intensive interventions or tier three interventions as along with progress monitoring. And the one is the work on tier three intervention is fairly new, and Sarah Powell, the co-presenter, who will actually do the majority of this particular session, is an expert and really is in the vanguard of really trying to think through how to do tier three well. We know certain ways how to do it badly, which is just to use certain remedial series and get a group of kids who maybe don't like math very much, have a history of failure, and are doing a lot of boring arithmetic stuff in middle school that they have already been exposed to and don't really understand, but how to kind of intelligently do that and how to use data to at least investigate that is really a frontier area. And one where special education and RTI, the preventative end, really intersect. To give you a little bit of Sarah's background, then I'm going to set this up a little more. She taught kindergarten for years and was a researcher and did a lot of work in developing, at that point in time, primarily preventative or tier two interventions for young students. And she worked at Vanderbilt University with Lynn Fuchs and colleagues. And she's now an assistant professor of special education, the University of Texas in Austin, with a focus on math for kids with disabilities and difficulties in math. And you can see Sarah's picture up there. And that, so as I said, our major focus is going to be on tier three, but you will get a lot of exposure to progress monitoring, and as we learned from our earlier the input we got on the screening measures, and in many cases the screening and PM measures are the same, many of you feel or seem to feel okay about what you use, but feeling there could be a lot better than what's currently available. And Sarah will walk you through resources in a little bit. The other issue, which it's a little bit too early for us to broach, but I've stressed this before and want to stress it again in my brief remarks this afternoon, is that one thing we want to be careful of, and we can't do that till the new state assessments have been offered, or the part smarter balanced, or whatever states ultimately wind up using, have been out for a year or two, but we want to make sure that the psychometrics and validity information that is presented by developers and publishers uses updated tests, because just because something correlates with a test in wide use 5 or 7 years ago doesn't mean it's going to be valid for the current curriculum. And that's something expressed a little bit in the chat, but I'd like you to keep that in mind as we go through this, and that Tier 3 is what comes up is most people say we know almost nothing about Tier 3. The publishers are very vague. Most of the material seems more Tier 2, preventative-oriented. And what we're going to focus a lot is an idea that is maybe not as old as special education, but really began in the 1960s in particular. Database instruction and database individualization has a long, long history in special education. One of the problems is people were not always sure what to collect data on and whether that data was valid. But essentially, the focus for today is going to be on database individualization, and Sarah's going to talk about the situations where it makes sense to do a preventative grade level intervention where it's more or less one size fits all, possibly with some care going to grouping of students so that they can move at about the same pace. And when you really want to provide the level of intensive individualization that is necessary for some students, the students who typically don't thrive, not only with Tier 1, but with typical instruction. And this is something from the National Center of Intensive Intervention. It's a resource I've talked about a little. Sarah is going to talk some more about them. I'm an advisor to the center, and Sarah is one of the folks involved in implementation. We have some poll questions here, 1 and 2. We'll just take you 30 seconds each or so. That gives us and you a sense of who's who and what you do. And I think we're pretty much all done. As usual, we have a spread cutting across the board from math specialists and coaches to RTI coordinators. And so it's probably a little bit of everything. I mean, basically every category is represented, and which is ideal for an RTI system because really everybody needs to be a part of it. Roles change a little bit. And what we see here is pretty typical, I think, around the country in math, unlike in reading, where over half of you feel you know something about RTI and math, but have a lot more to learn. One thing, there's been a lot less research on intervention and RTI and math. That's been less true for measurement and progress monitoring, but in terms of instruction and how all the pieces fit together in math, it's just there's much less research and much less evidence, so that's rapidly changing. There's been real advances in the last 5 years, which I've tried to share with you and which Sarah will in a second. This is, so we can ditch the polls now. This is a resource that I keep pushing. It's totally free. I chaired the group that came out with this 6-7 years ago. It really tries to put together a whole picture of the pieces of RTI and give you a sense of where there's strong evidence and where there's moderate evidence or where there's minimal or no evidence. And here you can quickly see the areas. I think there's going to be no shockers as to the areas where there's evidence in. And what we try to do in the guide is give you practical examples of how an RTI system can be set up. With this caveat, we used what research and knowledge was available then, so we did not spend much time on intensive or tier three, because 7 years ago it was not an organized body of knowledge. What we said about progress monitoring then, and I want to, this will be my last slide and I'll turn things over to Sarah, is that the level of evidence was low, and invariably people are a little bit shocked or surprised by that, because usually the first thing people talk about in RTI is universal screening and progress monitoring. And the main reason we did this, and this is a little bit of a review of what I shared a couple of weeks ago, but probably worth repeating, in most interventions, in most preventative interventions, be they tier two or tier three, the main assessments done were daily, were at the end of each lesson or occasionally at the end of the week. There were little mastery probes. Sometimes there were review items. But basically, the age-old practice in small group instruction to see, did the group learn or seem to understand the material they were covering today or the last few days? And if there was evidence that, you know, in a group of three or five, they weren't learning that, that you need to spend some more time on it than the next lesson. In no case of a study with proven effects to raise achievement was there the kind of progress monitoring you're accustomed to from EZCBM or AIMSWeb or the numerous other systems. In some cases, it was done, but the interventionist never saw it. It was sent to the university and used for further analyses of growth trends, et cetera. So that was that was the main reason we said we have no proof, we have no causal evidence for this. The other thing is the psychometrics for the math measures were okay, and there's a very good article for those of you who really like measurement, perhaps some of the school psychologists, by Ann Fagan and Stan Dino and their colleague, Dr. Juban, that really showed that the psychometrics for math measures, with the exception of those for very young kids, K and 1, usually are not nearly as good as in reading. Another thing that began to emerge around 6-7 years ago is that to get a stable slope, which we know from the definition, responsiveness to intervention, typically relies on establishing a slope so you can determine whether the student is growing or whether this growth is basically flat, or hopefully it's not negative, but it takes 12 data points, which is massive to do in a full RTI system where you might have perhaps a third of your students or a quarter of your students receiving some kind of intervention. So those were all limitations to the evidence. The reason we put progress monitoring in there is, first of all, it was a panel, and there were some people who this was definitely their belief and what they were trained in and what they taught. But most importantly, it seemed that, and I pushed this position, that one advantage of monitoring progress for your kids in the at-risk category is you get a picture of how all the pieces are fitting together. In some kids, it might be tier one and tier two, which, as we know, sometimes can be nicely aligned, very often go their own way, and many kids spend a good deal of time in their core classroom math instruction, and you want to know, is the intervention helping them benefit from that time at all? And also, some kids may spend time in their regular class, do the tier two intervention, and then, using some of the methods Sarah will show you in a few seconds, be engaged in tier three. But how is this whole package fitting? And that's where progress monitoring can be great to do. So this would be for intervention kids, especially those that you're troubled. It could also be occasionally looking grade-wise or school-wise even to just see, is this program making sense for these at-risk second graders or fourth graders, or is the intervention so misaligned with what's going on in the classroom where they're spending more and more time on fractions and their intervention is spending a lot of time on multi-digit operations and there's no synergy there. It's not working for kids. And the other point I want to make was borderline students. What we find is that most screening measures, lead to a lot of false positives. A lot of kids get tier two intervention who would do fine without it. So for those students who are very close to the cut point, and probably either way, you may want to monitor how they are doing in tier one rather than putting all these resources into K1 and 2 math interventions to use your resources a little more shrewdly. And then if the kid isn't gaining from tier one instruction, you know there's a problem, so 6 weeks in or something, you can do some further assessment or move that child into a group. And so that is basically the prelude in setting the stage, and I'm now going to turn things over to Sarah, and I'll be involved in the Q&A, and if questions come up towards the middle, we'll have one in the middle. If not, we'll do that on the hour. So thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Again, I'm Sarah, and I'm going to talk with you about using progress monitoring within an RTI or multi-tiered system of support system, and thinking about how for students that have been non-responsive at these other tiers, how we can individualize instruction and then use progress monitoring to understand whether those instructional changes have been beneficial to students. So I'm going to take over from here, although Russ is going to comment as needed. And if anyone has questions, they can type those in, and Russ will try to answer those as we go, or we will answer those at the break. So we are going to talk about DBI, which is Data-Based Individualization. And much of this work is coming from the National Center for Intensive Intervention. You can Google Center for Intensive Intervention, and their website comes up as the first Google hit, or you can go to www.intensiveintervention.org, and all of the materials and much of the content that Russ and I are discussing today comes from that center. They are working specifically right now in four different states, Rhode Island, Minnesota, Missouri, and Michigan, but they're also trying to reach out their programming for RTI to other states across the United States, and all of their information is available online. So data-based individualization, it's a combination of intensive intervention for students that either have disabilities or are at risk for having a school-diagnosed disability. And progress monitoring is a major component of data-based individualization. And Russ has said that over the last few webinars, you've talked a lot about progress monitoring. And so today we're going to think about progress monitoring within this intensive intervention framework. So within an RTI framework, we're talking about students who are non-responsive to Tier 2, and how we conceptualize Tier 2 is small group tutoring, either in the general education classroom or outside of the general education classroom, but for students who are at risk but do not have a school-diagnosed disability or have not been diagnosed at this time. And we're also thinking about students who are non-responsive in Tier 3. Tier 3, as Russ said a little bit earlier, it's kind of could be thought of as special education, or it could just be more intensive intervention for these students who are at risk. And this population is extremely important to pay attention to, because we know that students with disabilities, they typically experience lower academic achievement than students without disabilities, and this leads to lower high school completion. We know that their access to post-secondary options is limited. Their employment opportunities also become limited compared to peers without disabilities, and we know that students with disabilities have more involvement in the criminal justice system. So we've got to think about things that we can do in school at the elementary and secondary levels so that some of these things are lessened for students with disabilities later on. So the diagram here on the right-hand side, and I will try to point here, this is really talking about the data-based individualization process. So we assume that students are in a Tier 2 program, so they're receiving small group instruction. We're going to talk about mathematics today. And teachers are progress monitoring to see whether students are responsive or non-responsive to that Tier 2 instruction. And for those non-responsive students, these are the students that we are most concerned about, we're going to do a diagnostic to figure out where these students, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and where these students need to the most work. We're going to adapt the intervention, which I'm going to talk about ways to do that pretty easily today. And then we're going to continue to progress monitor, and I'm sure that Russ has emphasized this over the last few webinars, that progress monitoring is continual for these at-risk or students with disabilities, because we really need to understand whether they're responding to instruction or whether they're not responding, and if they're not responding, we can quickly make instructional changes for these students so that we're not just letting them go through a program and if the program is not working for them. So this diagram over here is on the intensive intervention site, but it's also what we're going to talk through today. And data-based individualization is to address students that have severe and persistent learning difficulties. These are typically students that are several grade levels below mathematics performance where we would expect them to be. And as emphasized by the last two bullet points, data-based individualization is driven by progress monitoring data, and we're going to increase the intensity for students so that they can get the most out of the, I think I did something there. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So Molly, I just clicked off of the PowerPoint. I don't know what happened to it. Oh, okay. There we go. All right, so before we get started, because progress monitoring is such an important component, I'd like to ask you to answer the questions for poll 3 about what is your current satisfaction with your progress monitoring system. Are you very satisfied, satisfied, indifferent, or not satisfied? So I'd like to get a little bit of an idea of where you are all right now. Whoa, okay, lots of people not satisfied. All right, so it looks like most people have voted, and most of you are not satisfied with your current progress monitoring system. So I don't have the magic potion to help you with figuring this out today, but I think Russ, over the past few webinars, has given you some things to think about. But you cannot really do any of this database individualization without a good progress monitoring system. So that means that you understand progress monitoring measures in mathematics, you know how to administer and score them, and you know how to interpret the data. Because it's that data that's going to drive everything in terms of database individualization. Now I'm going to go over the basics of database individualization for the next few minutes, and then we will talk about some progress monitoring measures that are out there, and also a way that you can assess progress monitoring measures and perhaps find a good fit for you, the students in your classroom, the students in your school, and the students in your district. So I'm sorry that so many people are disappointed with their current progress monitoring system, but it is very important to get a good system in place so that all of these other things can fall into place there. All right, so let's talk a little bit about database individualization. So DBI is a systematic method for taking data and figuring out when we need to make instructional changes and whether those instructional changes have been beneficial for students or not beneficial. And so a lot of this comes from work in special education that has been done over the last 30 years. And the one thing that's to emphasize here, I'll click forward here. Molly, thank you for getting that loaded up. Is that DBI is not, DBI is not a program that you can actually purchase. It's not a single strategy that you use, but it's more a process for helping teachers and school administrators think through how can we really intensify intervention for a student where what we're doing currently is not enough for the student. And it isn't a one-time fix. You just don't do intensive intervention, DBI, one time. It's one of those things. It's a continual part of the RTI process. So when I talk about this within an RTI framework, I may use the term Tier 3. You could think about it as Tier 3 instruction, special education instruction, or just very intensive instruction for students who have been deemed non-responsive at the general education level, Tier 1, or at the small group level, which is Tier 2. So the students that need tier need the DBI and the intensive intervention, these are students who are at risk or have a disability and they're not making adequate progress. And we're looking at students that have very low math performance. So perhaps a sixth grader performing mathematics at a second grade level, or maybe even a first grader that is still working with very, very early numeracy skills. So these are students that have participated in general mathematics instruction that has shown not adequate enough. They've participated in small group intensified instruction. That's not enough. And so we need to do something different for these students. And every time that decision is made that this is not enough for these students, that decision has been made based on progress monitoring data. So looking at the student's slope, their slope is maybe flat or not steep enough. And looking at the students' end levels on their progress monitoring measures, and we're seeing that their end levels are below benchmark data where we would expect typically performing students to be. And many of these students who require intensive intervention have been participating in Tier 2 instruction, and it just hasn't been enough for these students. Now, one of the things that we do want to say is that within an RTI framework or an MTSS framework, students, you typically start in Tier 1. Progress monitoring has shown that the students are not responsive in Tier 1, so they move to receive Tier 2 instruction. In Tier 2, the students have been progress monitored, and that progress monitoring data has shown that the students are not responsive in Tier 2, so those students require Tier 3 instruction. But for some students, they actually may move more quickly throughout a tiered system because of need. So that might be a student that has moved into the district and is showing that they are several grade levels below where we would expect them to be, and you're going to immediately move them to Tier 3 or special education because they require those services. So this should be made on an individual case-by-case basis for students. But for the most part, students will start in Tier 1, move to Tier 2, and then if that isn't enough, we're going to place them in Tier 3. Now, there are several steps to DBI. The most important thing that I'm trying to emphasize, and Russ has been doing this as well, is that progress monitoring is a key component of database individualization. The progress monitoring is going to demonstrate, the progress monitoring scores demonstrate whether students are responsive or non-responsive to these different changes that we make for the students' program. We're also going to conduct a diagnostic assessment. This is actually typically informal. It can be formal, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, but this determines the student's areas of strength and weakness, and then we're going to provide intensive intervention focused on those areas of weakness for the student. We're going to adapt and adjust the student's instructional program, and then we're going to make both qualitative changes and quantitative changes. I'll talk about that in a little bit. And then we're going to measure those changes based on the progress monitoring data that's continually gathered from the students. And the DBI is often, uses tier 2 intervention, but it might be tier 3 intervention. It's typically small group instruction, or it can be individual instruction. And that really, we see differences from school to school based on what the school has set up in terms of RTI and so on and so forth. So before we begin DBI, all students should be participating in a good tier 2 mathematics intervention program. We suggest starting with a standardized program, but we know in a lot of cases those are not available for a specific math topic or for at a specific grade level. And so we just ask that with the tier 2 intervention, just with RTI or MTSS, and within that framework, that's an evidence-based program that we know that this works for most students most of the time. So students are doing this tier 2 program. Progress monitoring shows that it's not enough for these students. And so then we really have to figure out what can we do to this program to enhance it and intensify it for the student. And as Russ said earlier, students should participate in tier 2 for several weeks. It's actually typically about 10 to 14 weeks to establish a adequate slope. He was talking about 12 data points are needed to establish adequate slope. But again, some students may move quicker through the DBI process because they need the specialized and individualized services at this point. Now, if we're thinking about the three tiers, this is a nice table that kind of breaks them down. The tier one, or primary prevention, we have evidence-based programs going on in terms of instruction. It's class-wide. Progress monitoring is typically done around benchmark times, which that would be fall, winter, and spring, and all students receive Tier 1. Now, for those students that are not responsive to Tier 1, they move to the secondary prevention program, or Tier 2. That's T2 on the graph. And here we're using evidence-based practices within small group instruction. Group size varies. It might be as few as 2 students. It might be as many as 7 or 8 students. Sometimes in the middle school and high school grades, we see group size up to 10 to 15 students. And here the progress monitoring takes place at least once per month, but the actual recommendation is at least every other week or every week. The more data you can gather on these students to really understand the changes that are taking place from week to week, that's going to enhance the decision-making process for teachers. And the population that is in secondary prevention are at-risk students. And then we finally get to intensive intervention, or Tier 3, and this is going to be individualized based on student data. And just because it's individualized based on student data doesn't mean that all students are receiving individual instruction. Group size might be anywhere from 1 to 3 students. Many times we can group students into homogeneous groups and service several students at a time who all require intensive intervention on several math skills. Here, you have to progress monitor weekly, and so this goes back to that question about, are you pleased with your progress monitoring program? And if the answer is no, that means there are some red flags that are popping up for you. So we need to think about progress monitoring program that you can use, that you find palatable and helpful, because we are going to use that progress monitoring data gathered weekly to understand whether the intensive intervention is helping the students or whether we need to make a change. And again, students who are in intensive intervention are the students that are at risk for disability or have a disability, students who are typically performing several grade levels below in terms of mathematics performance. So if we go to the next slide here, questions about the secondary intervention. So we are going to take this secondary intervention, which is what the teachers are doing at Tier 2, and we're going to intensify it. So many times with intensive intervention, we're not asking teachers to completely scrap what they've been doing and start all over. We're actually going to say, okay, if you have an evidence-based program running at Tier 2, then we're going to tweak that program, maybe some minor tweaks, maybe some major tweaks, and those tweaks are going to be individualized for the student's needs. So the thing you have to ask yourself is the program that you're using, is it meeting the student's needs? And if it's a match for what the student needs in terms of mathematics instruction, then you're going to keep using that Tier 2 program. So for example, if a student needs a lot of work covering fractions and you are working within a evidence-based fractions program, then you're going to keep that program and intensify it based on the individual student. Now, if you realize that the student has a lot of gaps in their fraction knowledge and you're not using a secondary prevention program focused on fractions, then you want to choose a secondary program that does have a fraction, a heavy fraction focus, so that that's appropriate for the student's needs. Now, other questions you need to ask yourself is, have you been covering key components of the program? Have you been implementing the program as it's meant to be implemented? So that means if it's supposed to be implemented 3 times a week, have you been doing that, or have you only been doing it once or twice a week, and have you been doing it for the full 30 minutes, or does the student only receive 20 minutes of instruction? So if you can answer that you've been doing this the full 30 minutes and you've been doing it 3 times a week, then maybe that's not the part that you need to intensify. But if you haven't been able to do that, then it's time to think about intensifying those aspects of the program. And then with the third bullet point, you have to ask yourself, have I gathered enough data to understand whether the student is responsive or non-responsive in order to detect a change in performance? So again, this is where the weekly progress monitoring comes into place. And it's really important to do that because we're going to make decisions pretty quickly for these students because we know that they require intensive intervention and they require it now. Now, when we work with teachers and they say, well, why should I start with a standardized Tier 2 program? Again, I said we don't want you to reinvent the wheel, but we want you to have something to work from, and then we are going to tweak that program and intensify it. And many times with these standardized programs, you don't need a lot of training. You don't have to create a lot of materials. It's all there for you to use, and then we're going to enhance it. And it's really important with everything, and we hopefully you all have talked a lot about this within RTI and multi-tiered systems of support, is that everything that we're using at Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3 should have an evidence base. So that means it has been researched to show that it works for most students most of the time. So thinking about how to find those, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that on the next slide. So one of the ways that you can find good secondary prevention programs is from the National Center for Intensive Intervention. Here's their link to the website for their tools chart. So they have tools charts about progress monitoring, and Russ may have talked to you about that on previous webinars. I'm also going to hit it a little bit later, like the next 10 minutes. But this is the tools chart for good secondary prevention programs, and this has a list of both the reading programs and the mathematics programs. But here, what the National Center has done is evaluated programs that you could use with Tier 2 and Tier 3 students in terms of the design of the study, how well the study was implemented, and whether there were positive outcomes associated with the study. So rather than just choosing a mathematics program and saying, oh, this one has a nice website, this one looks good, but you don't actually know if the program has an evidence base, you can use this website to look and see which programs have an evidence base, or a stronger evidence base than others. And I'm not going to name any programs now, but you can go ahead and look through this website and walk through it yourself. And other resources that you might be familiar with are the What Works Clearinghouse. That doesn't have as good of a listing of secondary prevention programs as it does whole class programs, but it is a good place to start, as well as the Best Evidence Encyclopedia. This is a website from Johns Hopkins University. It's www.bestevidence.org. And they also have a listing of mathematics programs that have an evidence base. Across all these websites, the mathematics programs that are listed, there just are not as many as we see in reading. So you may feel that you're missing out on something, but right now lots of different organizations and universities across the United States are trying to conduct research to figure out whether programs have an evidence base. So you kind of have to keep looking back because things may pop up that weren't there 6 months ago. So this is a really great website to figure out a good secondary program that you can use and then start to intensify it for students that require that. So if you don't have a standardized program, you can also look at materials that have come from your core program, look at the IES practice guide that Russ hit on a little bit earlier, and you can also choose materials that are aligned with your standards, either the Common Core standards or your state-specific standards if you are not in a Common Core state. And or figure out where your students typically benefit, or what programs your students in your school typically benefit from the most, and start with those programs, and then you're going to tweak them and intensify them. All right. So thinking about how to intensify intervention, we have four suggestions that we've been working with. The first two are, the circles on the left, are a little bit easier to do. The second two are numbers 3 and 4. Those are the two circles on the right-hand side. Those are going to be a little bit more time-consuming, but all of these might be ways to intensify instruction for the students that you are working with. One student might only require a change of dosage or time. Another student might require you to intensify intervention according to all four of these aspects. So I'll talk a little bit about them, and then I'm going to ask you some ways that you've intensified intervention before with your students that are at risk or students that have disabilities. So our first practice, or our first way that you can intensify intervention, is changing the dosage or time. So again, you need to intensify intervention for students that have deemed or that have shown non-response to Tier 2 instruction, or it could also be Tier 3 instruction. And you understand that the students are non-responsive because of the progress monitoring data. Their progress monitoring data has shown that their slope is flat, or it's not steep enough to reach either end of the semester or end of the year goals. And so when you look at that slope and you say, oh my gosh, this student is not on track to meet their end of the year goal, you need to intensify their intervention. And this practice number one is really like the easiest way to intensify intervention. So practice number one, again, is changing the dosage or time. So this is increasing the quantity of instruction that the students receive. So this is increasing the minutes per day that the students receive, or the minutes per session. Perhaps a student only meets with you 3 times a week for 30 minutes, so maybe now you will do 3 times a week for 40 minutes. You can increase the sessions per week, maybe going from 2 sessions to 4 sessions. From what we know, from based on the research and our experiences, is that students really need constant intervention. So 1 session a week typically is not going to cut it, but students really require about 3 to 5 sessions per week. So it's pretty constant, the material, they're reviewing it on a constant basis, and they are being able to review what they've learned previously in a timely fashion. So increased time, when we're talking about that, it allows the teacher to provide more instruction. It also allows teachers to provide more feedback for the students, maybe more specific feedback, and it also provides the teacher with time to provide more practice opportunities for the students. So instead of only getting to work on 3 fractions problems, the students get to practice 5 or 6. And we know that practice in mathematics is just like practice with the violin. If you are not practicing, then students are not going to improve. So by increasing either the minutes per day, the minutes per session, or the sessions per week, or the total number of sessions, you're giving students more opportunity to receive instruction, receive practice, and also receive feedback. So Denise has a question about how districts take, districts take from or add to in terms of adding additional time. So with the schools that I've been working with, I work with mostly schools in the state of Michigan, it's really up to the individual school. So several of our schools have what they call might be like, quote, an intervention time or RTI time or MTSS time, and students will receive that instruction within that time. Another school that we've worked with actually has students work with the teachers before and after school, or students sometimes miss less content-heavy courses. So perhaps the students only participate in art class for 30 minutes instead of 45 minutes, and they get the time, they then work in intervention time for those extra 15 minutes. If I knew the answer to the question about how to put this into the school day, I would have lots and lots of money, because people, that is like the most, the largest barrier that schools encounter in terms of doing RTI, doing MTSS, and doing intensive intervention, because, you know, the school day is pretty heavily mandated in terms of here's your math, your language block, here's your mathematics block, and then here's everything else that fits into the school day. So I wish I had one answer, but I could provide some, I could later write and provide some snapshot experiences from schools that I've been working with on how they add time into the sessions that the students
Yes. Sarah, this is Russell. I just wanted to add one comment there because this question comes up across the board.
All the time.
Is that, is the sounds working okay, correct?
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah. That basically, one thing that has been talked a lot about, especially with the school improvement grants, but more broadly by Secretary Duncan and numerous others, is extended learning time. And often people aren't sure, you know, well, what exactly does that mean? What do you do? But it seems that is an ideal time for for these add-on kinds of things. And especially because we know, you know, from a century that, you know, it is better, distributed learning is better than mass learning. So if you could spend a bit of additional time on math twice a day in a small setting. So I really see that as an underutilized option at schools.
Yeah.
Now, the transportation becomes a nightmare, but sometimes there's a mixture where then there's an array of activities ranging from, you know, hands-on science activities for some kids to interventions for kids who need it. But I think that because there is a finite amount of time in the school day, and it's not, the problem's not going to go away.
Yeah, and another, that's a great comment, Russ. And another thing that we have noticed a lot in terms of doing classroom observations of Tier 2 and Tier 3 instruction is that there is a lot of wasted time that teachers have during their, quote, 30-minute block. We've done observations where the teacher has 30 minutes, but there's only 18 minutes of instruction that actually occur. And so really thinking about if you do have 30 minutes, how to maximize the learning time. So that many times is teaching students, if they're coming to your classroom, to come in and go ahead and get started on this warm-up activity or whatever it is, and having all the materials ready. I was in a classroom pretty recently where a teacher spent about 4.5 minutes counting out base 10 blocks. If those were already a baggie and they were placed in front of the student, that would have saved 4.5 minutes. And so developing transitions and routines for what you're going to do with that 30-minute time period or what have you. So, and then you think that when you're thinking about changing the dosage of time, you really need to reflect upon what the student requires. So some questions you could ask yourself are, how far behind is this student? Are they 2 grade levels behind or 4 grade levels behind? So you have to think about what foundational skills do I need to fill in for this student in order for this student to perform at grade level. Was Tier 1 appropriate, or did the student not pick up any of the Tier 1 instruction? If it's an older student, they're probably going to require more time with the intensive intervention just because many times these older students have many more gaps that we need to fill. And what is the complexity of the learning task? If the student is learning to solve word problems algebraically or solve problems about ratios and proportions, that may take a lot more time to provide instruction on than if the student is working on basic subtraction skills. And also thinking about the student's stamina and their attention span. And so one of the things that we do have some schools doing is doing a double dip where the students actually receive instruction twice a day, maybe 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes in the afternoon, because the student's attention span is just about 15 minutes. And so that really maximizes the on-task time that the teacher has with the student. So it's not 30 continuous minutes, but it's 30 minutes broken up against across the school day. And with all these practices 1, 2, 3, and 4, I do want to just say, and you probably all know this already, but that if you do make any changes in terms of the minutes, the sessions, or the total sessions, if the student has an IEP, the IEP has to be amended to reflect those changes. So that's practice number one here. Practice number two is changing the student's learning environment. And so what we mean by that is reducing the group size. Perhaps the student has been tutored in a group of 15 students, and the student exhibits a lot of off-task behavior and doesn't have an opportunity to interact with the teacher and provide appropriate feedback. So reducing the group size typically is something that helps the students. But we know a lot of schools are up against the wall. with this because many times they have to tutor these 8 students and they can't reduce the group size. But ways to think about that is that if there is an extra teacher, a paraprofessional, maybe even a student teacher, breaking the students into groups and having the teacher provide instruction while the instructional assistant helps the students with practice activities and things like that. Grouping students with similar needs. All these students require work on word problems. All of these students require work on geometry skills. So then there, the teacher can really focus instruction to help what those students require a support on. And then changing the instructional setting. Many times we'll see students that are tutored in the library and classes are coming in and out. So if you can, move to a small office in the library so that student distractions are removed and the teacher can really focus on the task in hand. Because we know that once students lose their focus, it typically takes teachers about 30 seconds to 60 seconds to bring those students back into the fold. And that's 30 to 60 seconds of instruction that the student has missed out on or that the teacher hasn't been able to provide because the teacher is trying to bring those students back into the fold. It looks like some people, based on comments, are struggling with scheduling, and some people have a lab time scheduled and that's kind of a little bit what we're talking about is a dedicated RTI or MTSS time for these students. But one of the things we a lot of times see, and I think that this comment comes from Sheila, and I've seen this as well, is that the students that require language arts or reading support are also the students that require mathematics support. So how do we, if we've got 30 minutes and these students have an RTI time of 30 minutes, do we spend that 30 minutes on reading, 30 minutes on mathematics? Do we split it? Do we do every other day? And things like that. So those are questions, and these questions we know schools across the United States are dealing with, and I'll try to provide some questions after the webinar finishes here. So practices 1 and 2 are quantitative changes that teachers can make to intensify intervention for students. And they're typically the approaches that teachers try first because they are maybe a little bit easier to do than practices 3 and 4. But practices 3 and 4 focus more on qualitative things that teachers can do to intensify intervention. So practice 3 is thinking about cognitive skills that we can combine that help students with their academic learning. And so thinking about most of our students that we'll be working with have difficulty with memory, either working memory, long-term memory, or both. And so those students will have difficulty with recall, maybe recall of basic facts, recall of steps to solve a word problem. They may have difficulty with organization of their work, which we know in mathematics a lot of times causes students to answer problems incorrectly if their work is not lined up and if they don't understand place value. So things that teachers can do in terms of memory is to teach note-taking skills, teach students to organize their work. Maybe that's via just graph paper or maybe using a graphic organizer. It might be using technology to help organize work. Teachers should think about presenting information in more than one way, so not always just presenting information orally, but presenting information visually. We know in mathematics that students really benefit from hands-on presentation and work with manipulatives. So giving opportunities to do that. And what we see in the middle school and high school grades is that students have very few opportunities to use hands-on materials to help understand mathematics concepts. I think many times manipulatives seem to be like kind of an, quote, elementary thing, and that's not true. There's a lot of research that supports hands-on learning for middle school and high school students to really help them understand either mathematical procedures and the mathematical concepts that accompany those procedures. So thinking about presenting information in more than one way helps students think about, be able to commit these things to long-term memory with meaning. Teachers should also teach routine, use mnemonics, teach algorithms, teach step-by-step processes, and help students remember these by maybe having checklists, using graphic organizers, and using mnemonics and those types of things. So really helping students increase their capacity for memorization of mathematics concepts and procedures. Other things, students' attribution. We need to work on how students feel about mathematics. Actually, the attribution research shows that as students increase their mathematics performance, their attribution increases. but teachers can help this by helping students plan and set goals, monitoring their goals. This is where progress monitoring can be used. Students can take a progress monitoring assessment and then do their own graphing and then set a goal. Next week, I want to be at this place, or in 3 weeks, I want to be here. And that goal setting aspect typically has very positive implications for students. And then also students help paying attention to the task at hand. So that might be thinking about a little timer that goes off every 60 seconds. Is the student on task? But it also might having the student understanding how a mnemonic works and a think aloud and working through steps to solve different types of problems. So thinking about these cognitive skills that we can tie in to the mathematics instruction that's occurring, and these are a way to intensify the instruction for students. And then practice number four is modifying the delivery of instruction. And this, there's lots of different ways that we can do this. Number one is considering the instructional match and prioritizing the skills to teach. What we know for students that are at risk and students with disabilities is typically they require about 10 to 30 times more practice on a skill than a typically performing student. And so we really need to figure out where the student's weaknesses are and how can we prioritize and provide instruction on those weaknesses so that they are not weaknesses any longer, and then we can start to improve other math skills. But mathematics is very linear. So if students are struggling with understanding addition and subtraction, they're probably going to struggle with multiplication and division. And if they struggle with whole numbers, they're probably going to struggle with rational numbers. So you may have to go back a few grade levels and start to fill in those gaps and those foundational skills. So really prioritize what do students need to know so that I can get them to this point or to meet this goal. I'm providing systematic instruction, so that's prioritizing and chunking instruction. So that and doing when you do systematic instruction, providing explicit instruction. So this is telling the students what they're going to work on, assessing background knowledge, doing teacher modeling. So this is the I do, we do, you do. You know, you sometimes see in general education that this is not exactly the approach that everyone takes, but the research from special education supports this. Over the last 30 years, that teacher modeling, teacher practice with the students, and then the students practice with teacher feedback, that's a very good approach to providing instruction for students that are at risk and students with disabilities. Really thinking about the simple, the language that you're using and making it simple and precise. And as it comes to mathematics, really thinking about the vocabulary that you're using. What does it mean to regroup? How can you show that to students, perhaps with manipulatives or technology, and really making sure that the language that you are using is as simplified as possible so that students can understand what's going on. And then providing frequent opportunities for responses. I recently read something that students should respond in some manner about every 30 to 60 seconds or else they start to tune out. So that might be asking for a low-level response. For example, you know, 3 + 4, what's the answer, everyone? Okay, the answer is 7. Or it might be a high-level response. What is a way that we can solve this word problem? What's another way we could solve this word problem? Or even having students, you know, respond with response cards, thumbs up, thumbs down, those types of things. But these opportunities that you embed within the instruction for student response really allow the teacher to understand whether students are on track or not on track. And then teachers need to provide specific feedback. We don't see that this is done as much as it is, but feedback should be tied to the student's actions and the student's goals. You always need to explain why something is incorrect, model a correct response, and then have students practice that back. I was in a classroom the other day where the teacher asked, what's 8 times 8? The student said 50, and then the teacher just asked for another student's response. And so for that student that said 50, they have no way of understanding what their mistake was, or no way of thinking, like, how can I correct myself if I make a mistake? And for feedback, it should be provided as immediate as possible so that students don't continue to practice incorrect methods and keep up with incorrect concepts. So those are the four ways to intensify intervention, just very, very briefly. So we'd like to ask poll number four. So what's one way that you're currently intensifying intervention? And then I want you to think about, based on your answer, what are some other ways that you can intensify the intervention for your students? So it looks like we've got some people that are doing a lot of quantitative changes, so dosage, time, environment. Oh, somebody's modifying their delivery. That's great. So thank you for responding. It does look like that most people are intensifying intervention currently, but I want you to think about other ways that we can do that, because that we know that's typically not just one practice for intensive intervention is enough, that many times students require at least two of these practices, if not all four. And if you want more information on how to modify based on the cognitive processes or how to modify your delivery of instruction, there's a lot of great resources on the intensive intervention site. So one of the things that we're about have to finish up here soon. So one of the things we want to think about is that when we're intensifying intervention, that progress monitoring component is mandatory. So DBI requires progress monitoring. If you tell me that you're doing database individualization and I ask you what your progress monitoring system is and you say, oh, we're not progress monitoring, then you're not doing DBI. So basically, DBI cannot function without progress monitoring. And when you're thinking about your progress monitoring measures, because many of you said that you're not terribly happy with what your school is doing currently, here are some websites or some of the more popular progress monitoring systems that are out there. And what you need to really think about is that the measures are reliable. So that means that if you are administering multiple probes, that you're going to get very similar scores from one administration to the next, because if you don't have reliable measures, then you can't have an adequate slope to understand whether the student's responding or not responding. And you have to check whether the measures are valid. So are they testing what they're actually supposed to test? So on these next few slides, I have a few things to look for. So is the content linked to the Common Core or whatever standards you are working from in your state? And is there concurrent validity with a current state assessment? So is this matching what the students are going to be expected to answer on their high stakes assessment? And one of the things that we note in red is that right now we're in a pretty drastic period of change, with this year as the first year for Common Core assessments in most states. And so progress monitoring measures have not been aligned against Common Core standards in the past, and they're working on that now. And so some of these things may not be available for the next 2 years. That doesn't mean that you can say, oh, I'm just not going to progress monitor for 2 years, but you could go ahead and start to use something, but then evaluate it on a yearly basis to make sure that it is valid with your high stakes assessment in your state and touching upon the standards that students are expected to know. So some of the progress monitoring sites, or these are websites, but some of the measures that students are frequently tested on with our EasyCBM. This one has a number of mathematics measures, so everything from numbers and operations, geometry measurement, algebra, measurement, and things like that. And they're specified at the grade level. So if you're looking for a progress monitoring measure for a third grade student, you can go and use the third grade probes from EasyCBM. Now, EasyCBM is nice because down here on the bottom left-hand side, it says demo account, and you can just click on there. And they actually have most of their progress monitoring measures available to download for free, at least the first 9 or 10 at each grade level. But if you want to use their scoring program, you have to pay for that. But there is access to the measures themselves, and so that's one of the things. We have a lot of teachers that use EasyCBM for that reason. If you are interested in assessing students at the late middle school and into high school level, you can use the stuff that comes from Iowa State. This is Ann Fagan and her research team. It's called AIMS, and they have a bunch of pre-algebra and algebra progress monitoring measures. They assess very, very basic skills, have students solving for X and Y, and they actually have measures that go all the way to functions, quadratic equations, and so on and so forth. Other site that you'll see on the Intensive Intervention website is MClass. They have early numeracy measures starting with counting a missing number, and then they have everything up to through 8th grade, I believe, with concepts and applications problems and computation problems. And then if you are wanting to know which progress monitoring measures have been evaluated by the Intensive Intervention site, You can go to their tools chart. This is a snapshot of it. But you can just go to intensive intervention and click on tools charts up there at the top, and you can go to the progress monitoring. These are general outcome measures. But you can see that there's different measures that have been evaluated in terms of their reliability and validity, and especially their use for gathering good slope data for these students. So I think we are about done on time. The next few slides have just a case study of a student named Jason as he works through mathematics with his teacher. He's a fifth grade student performing at pretty much a third grade level, and the ways that his teacher intensifies intervention for him. But you're welcome to go through those slides on your own. There's nothing that is without explanation on the slide. But the one thing I do want to show, I'll just skip ahead a few things here because we do want to answer some questions from participants, is that with Jason, progress, his teacher is using EasyCVM. This is an example of the EasyCVM measure that the teacher is using. And you can see this EasyCVM measure has a huge focus on fractions. And Jason needs work on fractions, and his teacher is using a fractions secondary prevention program. So it's testing what Jason needs work on, and this also aligns with Common Core standards. But Jason, all the decision making for Jason based on his intensive intervention is based on his progress monitoring graph. So Jason's baseline is the first three data points. His initial instruction shows that he is not on target to meet his end of semester goal. So the teacher makes an instructional change here. She actually provides more time for Jason to work within the intervention. And she also adds a fluency component to the program. And so with that, we see the instructional change just after four data points that Jason is not on target to meet or even get up close to his end-of-the-year goal. And so rather than just letting Jason flounder down here for weeks 15, 16, and 17, the teacher makes another instructional change. So she conducts a strengths and weaknesses assessment and understands that Jason needs a lot more work on his basic facts and more explicit instruction on fractions. So she provides that for him, and then we see another instructional change as noted after the green line, and there you can see that Jason is starting to see an upward trend, but we might actually need an intensive intervention change again for him. But this intensive intervention is responding to the student's needs very quickly and efficiently to make the changes that are going to help these students the most. So I'm going to finish there so that we can answer some questions. I'll let Russ come on, and we will go ahead and start with, I think, Valerie's question, and Russ is going to take that away.
Yeah, I think we won't be able to get to all of these, but as it's usual here, some of you respond to each other's questions, and the chat is fascinating to look at. Rather than deal with the time issues, because they're severe, and there's only so much Sarah and I can do. I think these are systemic issues, and as folks point out, the two classic problems are there are quite a few kids who need help in reading and in math. So that's a huge issue, and the other is there are some kids where it's okay to miss art and music for others. That's the highlight of their day, and the last thing you want to do is take away the one or two or three things during the day, be it art, math, science, art, music, science, that they love. I don't know that we can answer those. The ones about the Common Core standards and how they fit our kids who are in these intensive interventions in Tier 2, I think the discussion was a very good one, and what it was is the Common Core asked kids to be able to show a multiplication in four different ways, I believe, was the way Valerie framed it. And what can we do? And I disagree a bit with the response that we should expose that student to all four ways and stop there. I like more the idea someone was talking about tape diagrams or strip diagrams, that what I would see we may want to do is modify the goal temporarily for that student and perhaps have her or him show it in two or three ways, but not skip it, not just go to calculation only and skip all the sense of understanding and understanding that multiplication is, in a sense, repeated addition. And so I think we still want to make sure that we cover those operations involving understanding, because they're ultimately the hook that kids are going to retain the information. So we may need to tone or tamper them down, but we want to go beyond exposure. And we do want to understand, though, and that's where Tier 3 is ideal, that this is going to be particularly difficult. Many students are in Tier 2 and Tier 3. The cognitive processes are such that they don't do very well with abstract, retaining abstract material and quickly learning the abstract language of math. But I would include those as goals. Ultimately, they can be motivating. And I think what Sarah was getting at in the Jason case, which had to be done very quickly, which is fascinating to look at in more detail, but that essentially you can combine that kind of work, which takes more of a skilled teacher, with some of the critical but less demanding teaching part of the fact practice, building the fluency in multiplication so the kid can understand what's going on with equivalence, which might be able to be done by a paraprofessional, by a peer tutor, by technology. So that's my answer to that little set, or my response. And Sarah, you may want to take another group.
Okay. So, Shanna, you say you don't see the senior students once a week with STAR. I could see that as well. So that might be, because that takes quite a while. So you might be interested in finding a progress monitoring measure that's pretty brief to administer. Many of the, if you're just doing the computation measures, those typically take 2 to 3 minutes and they can be administered in a group setting. And so you do that and you collect them and you grade them after the students finish with the assessment. So you may want to think about finding one that is much quicker. And in fact, I think the longest progress monitoring measure that you'll see out there takes 8 minutes, and those are at the upper grades. Oh, maybe the algebra stuff takes 10 minutes. But it is, if we are gathering this data, if we are gathering the data weekly, it is going to really benefit the students in the long run. So you may end up taking about 5 minutes away from instruction so that you can gather this information so that you can really tailor the instruction for the individual students.
There's one question I just looked, it was addressed to me about what I meant by systemic. I just meant issues that come up, like should we start intervention in math early? The answer is yes. I think there's compelling data there. But by systemic, it's everything from at times even getting, you know, the school board, the principals involved in saying this is critical. If we have Title I monies or whatever money, preventative special ed money, it shouldn't all go to reading. We need to put people in, and it's that kind of issue. So that's what I meant by systemic.
We have another question from Luann about diagnostic academic assessments to find strengths and weaknesses. So, Luann, you can do this formally or informally. Formally, you could administer something like the key math. I mean, that's a pretty common one. It breaks it down by component areas and gives you a lot of information about the student. It does take a long time to administer the key math, typically 30 to 60 minutes to administer the entire thing. So you can use some subtests from anything from like the WJ3, or you can use something from even if the Brigance, if you have that, or the GMAT, or you know, whatever you have. But you don't always have to use a formal assessment. I mean, you can use a formal progress monitoring assessment and do an error analysis. So look at the students' last progress monitoring assessment and see, okay, what types of problems are they doing well on? Are they doing well on the word problems? Are they doing well on the fractions problems? Are they doing well on the measurement problems? Or where are their areas of weakness? So you can really use pretty much any mathematics assessment that the student is using and take an error analysis approach to breaking it down by problem type. And in an informal way, you could ask students to explain a problem to you doing a think aloud and seeing what the gaps are in terms of their steps for solving a specific type of problem. And you can use, you could ask, if students are peer tutoring, you could listen to their explanations to see like where they are excelling and where they need work. And those are just some of the things that we've done in our research projects that have been in schools to help find the students' strengths and weaknesses. But typically we see that teachers are using a more informal approach than a formalized approach to just really figure out, okay, the student needs work here, here, and here. They're doing okay here, so let's focus on the areas where they need the most work. And Teresa, Russ is answering about computer system instruction.
And I'm thinking it may be time for people to fill out their evaluations.
I mean, they're fascinating.
But,
the thing, Teresa, I'll just speak to it, maybe Russ can talk about it a little bit, is that for many of these computer programs that we see, they look awesome. They do not have an evidence base at this time. And many computer programs that I've observed where students are working don't have a very good feedback component. And I know people are working on this. I mean, there's some really cool stuff coming out with artificial intelligence to actually respond to students when they answer incorrectly, but right now we don't have a lot of that. And so I would always default to actual teacher instruction over computer instruction. I think computers are probably better for building fluency than providing initial instruction or filling in gaps of knowledge than computers at this time, but that could change in 3, 5, 10 years' time.
Probably because we're going to sign off now, I think. Thank you very, very much. Questions,
thank you very
please.
Much. Yes. And if you have any questions or comments, I put my email address on the last slide. So you're welcome to email me if you want more resources or if you want any questions answered.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Molly.